never allow anybody to write the narrative for their lives. Don't become imprisoned by the culture.
Hello and welcome to A Pixie from Kilmarnock, a program about the people, places, and the history of the Northern Neck of Virginia. I'm your host, Pixie E. Curry. An organized church is a force to be reckoned with, and at the helm is the pastor. I can only say that the person who has the courage of their conviction and faith to lead their congregation, to be a voice for their community, to share the good news, to give encouragement where despair dwells, is a special person. Reverend Rodney D. Waller is such a person. He faced heartbreak, uncertainty, opposition, and emerged joyful, determined, and triumphant. Reverend Waller is the senior pastor for First African Baptist Church, Richmond, Virginia, a church with a long and deep, rich history in the River City. But his journey began in a church in another River City. I interview Reverend Waller March of 2023. His alma mater, Lancaster High School, had just won the state championship as the undefeated Lancaster County Boys Basketball Team 2023.
My name is Rodney D. Waller. I am the senior pastor of the First African Baptist Church, Richmond, Virginia. I have several degrees. I have a bachelor's in philosophy and religion from Virginia Union University. I have a master's of divinity degree from Samuel DeWitt Proctor School of Theology. I have an earned doctorate degree from Virginia University of Lynchburg. I have an executive MBA degree from Virginia Union University, a postgraduate certificate from Oxford and London, England. I have several awards. Pastor of the Year, Co-Pastor of the Year for Richmond through the Ushers Union. I am a native of Weems, Virginia. I attended a Lancaster public school system.
And your birth date?
December the 5th, 1969.
The cusp of the Freedom of Choice Force Integration era.
Correct.
What elementary schools did you go to?
Well, I went to Lancaster Middle School, Lancaster Elementary School, and Lancaster County.
You graduated when?
1989.
You're just a baby. What were some of your fondest memories of living on the Northern Neck?
Just growing up with family, everybody seemed to know each other or knew each other. I think that was probably the fondest memories I have, just the fact that family was family. Families got together, families enjoyed being with one another. Small town. It was as though everybody knew everybody. So it was never a moment where you felt as though someone was a stranger. And if it was a stranger, it was not something that could not be overcome or overcame to build relationships with those individuals. So it was just family, just being in a small town. I never had a moment where, as a matter of fact, I recall when we didn't lock doors. Persons did not have to lock their doors, and or you could go next door and borrow something from somebody because you was in need of that. So it was just a different place.
Didn't lock your doors and kept the keys and ignition in your car.
Yeah.
What is your earliest recollection of racism while living on the Northern Neck?
Well, when I received the questions, I was thinking about that, and so much was going through my mind because I think a lot of stuff or experiences that we saw around the country and we read about or saw it on television, I don't think I can honestly say that it was something that I thought was not the norm. Other than I realized that we couldn't go to the ball diamond. I remember as kids growing up, the ball diamond on 200. As bad as we wanted to go up there and play softball or baseball, we were not allowed. I remember people talking about going to Lee's Restaurant. At that time, African-Americans was not allowed to go to Lee's Restaurant. I remember growing up and going to the drugstore on the corner in Kimana. And I remember you would look at the bar, but I never saw African-Americans sitting at the lunch counter in the drugstore. And for me, I just took it as it was a part of life. I had got to the place, and I'm still at that point. You know, if you don't want me to be a part, I'm cool. You know, I'm okay with not being a part of the group. Being comfortable with who I am, that's how I've gotten to the place. When I think back now to those moments, it was those moments that I believe I was introduced to some type of racism or classism. It was those things that I had heard people talk about, but it had became a part of life for me. Oh, yeah, I do remember, though. I do remember when we went to the movie theater, me and my friends and cousins went to the movie theater, and I remember one night we were chased. We were chased by a white guy in a car, and he chased us, and we hid in one of the alleys until my cousin's mother showed up to pick us up. I do remember that. There was a guy chasing us through Kimana.
The Brookvale 1969 championship team finally received their rings 51 years later, and the ceremony was held at that very same baseball field. And one of the members of the team talked about not being able to play at that diamond.
Yes, I was at that event, and when he was speaking, I was standing there thinking about how many times the police came. There was moments we went there and was playing as children, and persons would ride by, and they would literally call the cops, and the cops would come, and we would take off running because we were not supposed to be on that diamond. And so, yeah, I remember. But actually playing an official game, no, I've never played an official game as a child on that diamond.
Did you play sports when you were in school?
Yes, ma'am. I actually was a part of the 1986 basketball team that went undefeated until the last game. We were ranked number one in the state of Virginia, and we lost the last game in the regionals before playing to go to state, and we ended up 24-1. And so when we listen and look at the team that just went undefeated, I'm so proud of those guys to be able to do what no other team have done. But yes, in 86, we were undefeated.
The twins, Mozell and Wardell Carter, they were part of that 1969 baseball team. They were instrumental in mentoring a lot of young men. And I wonder how many of those young men were part of that Lancaster High School basketball team that was undefeated. Were the children of parents that knew the twins. Now, that level of achievement is just phenomenal.
I think these kids that's part of the state championship team that went undefeated are probably grandchildren, or maybe a couple of their parents knew Wardell Mozell Carter. But I personally knew them. I played basketball with them. I played softball with them. So I personally have had the privilege of being in their presence. And I'm thankful that I did.
Gifted, wonderful, compassionate men.
Yes.
What led you to your present occupation?
Do you want the clip note version or the long story?
Go for the long story.
In 1978, matter of fact, prior to 78, I am just so blessed to have had family that was willing to make sure that I would be in church. I recall those Sundays back in the 70s as a little boy. My uncle, Riley Fisher, and his wife, Bertha, which was my aunt, they were the persons that picked me up on Sundays. And many Sundays, I tried to hide from them, and they would not let me hide. They would sit there and wait for me. Matter of fact, there were many Sundays I got dressed in their car to go to Sunday school. What's interesting, I've always been intrigued about the Bible, something about the Bible. I can recall reading the Bible as a little boy, had many conversations about the scriptures. But in 1978, the December the 24th, about 6:15, my dad made this, I look back at it now, prophetic statement. But back then, when he made the statement, people thought it was foolishness or shooting a jive. He stood up in the floor and said God had called him to preach on that night. Well, within 5 to 10 minutes after leaving my grandmother's house, we're on our way home, and our car stalls in the road, and my father gets killed. Now, about 10 minutes early, he said God had called him to preach. 10 minutes later, he's deceased. And yet I lived. For many years, I continued to read the scripture, study the Bible. But just like every other young man or young child, you're mischievous. And so you end up doing things and engaging in activities and all of that stuff. But what was interesting, somewhere along the journey, I decided to go back to church. And I served in the church as an usher. In 1986, I had conversation with my pastor. I told him I felt God was calling me to preach into the ministry because I had this, I guess, an epiphany. An epiphany is an experience where it's like God is revealing himself to you. And I remember calling everybody that and telling them that God was calling me to the ministry. A pastor said to me that Sunday, when you're ready, come down the front and make the announcement. Well, I put it off and said, I'm not going to do this. And it's amazing, Pixie, because I felt as though I was not qualified. I was not good enough to proclaim the word. And I even called and told my pastor about it. He said, well, just pray about it. It was, again, God gave a vision. He allowed me to see a vision of every reason why I needed to go into the ministry versus every reason why I felt as though I was not qualified. And so finally, I accepted the call into the ministry. And funny how cruel people can be to you when you make a step for the Lord based upon their perceived perception of your past. And once I made that statement that I was going to do this, I felt as though I became a new person. And so I studied under my pastor for a year, just studying and studying. And I remember my pastor got me enrolled in the certificate program at Virginia Union University, where I was studying biblical studies and preaching and scriptures. I never forget that June that my pastor stood up and said, I was ready. He was ready to turn me loose. And the next month, the pastor's deceased. He died. I'm grateful the church allowed the interim of the church, Reverend Edwards, to go in as the intern, continue to guide me and help me. And then it was crazy because I get licensed in September of that year, and then he gets sick, and then he's down, and he's on life support, not expecting to make it. And for 90 days, I filled the pulpit, preaching every Sunday. And it was amazing because I learned so much, because I'm in school. And then experiences, there's nothing better than experience. You got to actually now do it. And all of a sudden, Reverend Edwards came back in. And then the church started bringing in preachers. They started bringing in preachers. And I want to go back. I want to go back to my uncle. We call him Uncle Boots. He was Deacon Allen at the church. My Uncle Boots, who lived next door to me, grew up. I mean, he's like a father figure. He played a major part in me going back to church. I got to give credit to Reverend Kenneth Elmore and Kern Allen Elmore, who was transporting me back and forth to work with them in Northern Virginia. And every morning going to work, they would be giving me Bible, talking to me about God. And I had to go back and throw that in because you can't leave people out that was a part of your journey. But Reverend Edwards came back, and all of a sudden, they started bringing in candidates for the church. Be the next pastor. And every pastor that came in said, you're supposed to be here. That's what they would tell me. You're supposed to be here. And so finally, Deacon Taylor came to me in the spring of that year, 1987. I think it was spring of 87 or 88. He said, Pastor, excuse me, Minister Marlowe, would you like to be the pastor of this church? And I said, let me pray about it. I went and prayed about it. I came back to Deacon Taylor after talking to a couple of my professors and praying about it, and I said, I will try this. with one condition, and that is you all would support me by letting me continue to go to school. He took it back to the committee, and then they took it to the church. And that May of 1988, church voted me in as a senior pastor of my home church. And there's so much of the journey I left out, and that's how I ended up in the ministry and pastoring the church, Sharon Baptist Church.
I want to make sure that I understand. You graduated from high school in 1989?
Yes.
But you was a minister in 1988?
Excuse me, I was a minister in 1998.
98, okay.
Yes, 98, excuse me, 98, okay. Yes.
I'm about to say, wow, you were in school and a minister.
When I look back at my journey, I would take nothing for it because everything that occurred and everything that happened helped shape me and develop me to become who I am today.
Oh, you talking about Boots Allen? Used to work the ties in?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Him and my mom was good buddies.
Yep, I know. I started going to Bible study with him. Matter of fact, because he gave me a job at Ties In, and I worked for him in the storeroom. We would leave Ties In, go home, and rest, and he would pick me up and take me to Bible study.
Well, that leads me to two questions then. What person motivated you as you was growing up, and also what was your first job?
Well, my first job was working at Westminster Canterbury. I don't really call it a job, but I thought I was going to work, and that was working for my own cathedral official on the trucks. I used to love to be on the trucks, and I remember when they would load the trucks with topsoil, we would get in the back of the truck and throw out the sticks so that there would be no sticks in the topsoil. I think if I had to say that was my job, that and working with my dad as a little kid, hauling junk. I remember we used to haul junk, go around on Saturdays and clean up junk and scrap out of people's backyards. But it's my first real pay job. It was Westminster Canterbury.
What did you do there?
I was a dishwasher.
So what person motivated you the most as you was growing up?
I guess I would have to say my brothers was the ones who was motivators for me. Because even now, they are some of my biggest encouragers, my brothers.
Who were some of your favorite teachers?
Well, when I read the question, you said that to me. I started reflecting on my favorite teachers. I have to say, at the particular time of being in their classes, and in retrospect, I thought they were the worst teachers in the world. But now, I can say they were my favorite teachers because they cared about my future. And they were willing to correct me in many areas that helped shape me for who I am today. And that is teachers like Mr. Harvey Boyer, Miss Mary Boyer, Miss Ernestine Fisher, Miss Ernestine Bird, Miss Felicia Carter. Those teachers, there was something about them. I remember acting up in class. I literally got, you couldn't do it now, but back then they did. I was actually disciplined by a couple of those teachers that really blessed my life now. And I thank God they did what they did.
I know what you mean.
I remember playing at the water fountain. And all of a sudden, when I came around, Miss Bird rapped me. She rapped me upside my head. And I got mad. And I said something, and she said, look, I can do that because not only am I your teacher, but I'm your cousin. Miss Ernestine Fisher, she kind of disciplined me one day really good. And what could I say? They were actually family, and they were really looking out for my best interest. And so they were probably the teachers that I really, really liked. really cared, really saw something. And there's a teacher that never taught me, but she taught my parents. She taught my dad. She taught me a major lesson. After one funeral, we had just buried her husband at Calvary Baptist Church in Kilmarnock. We did the committal at Sharon Baptist Church, and I had just become the pastor, and I was walking down the hall. And this teacher walked up to me. She was a retired teacher from the public school system. Elsie Coleman Bird. Elsie Bird Coleman, I think. She walked up to me and grabbed me by my collar. And I was like, oh, you know, kind of standing off. Because I really didn't know who she was until she told me. And she said, now, young man, you're a preacher now. I know all your people, and it's a whole lot of those Roberts people. And she said, you make sure you go to school, and you make sure you learn something, because you don't want to be an ignorant, dumb preacher. And from that moment, I learned the value of education. Yes, the Holy Spirit does a lot, but there's nothing like having something for the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, to use when you stand up to proclaim. And she also talked to me about etiquette and dress attire. And that's why, until today, if you come to my church, they know what uniform I'm going to have on if it's not a robe. You know what that is, Pixie? A black suit, a white shirt, and a black tie.
Yes, sir.
And that's all because of what she said to me that day standing in that hallway. And so every Sunday, black suit, white shirt, black tie. So those are teachers from the Northern Neck. And also, I can't leave out one of the former principals. He's resting in glory now, Mr. Mack Lawn, who used to keep me after school after I lost my dad. And I was going through this crazy place. I was seeking attention. He would keep me after school and take me home and talk to me, start valuing me. Mr. Alan Ball, his wife, Miss Ball. You can't leave those names off of the paper when you talk about your favorite teachers. Also, I got to go back and remember Coach Kidd. As far as my basketball journey, he was the one that helped shape me from an athletic perspective. And so those were some of my favorite teachers.
What are some of your favorite foods?
Oh, straight up, I love a nice New York strip. I love crab cake. I love shrimp. And I can eat a cheeseburger 5 times a week if I could. So that's my favorite food, shrimp, cheeseburger, crab cakes, steak, spaghetti, pizza. And I'm not supposed to have it, but French fries.
First African Baptist Church, which is the third oldest African-American church in the United States, and for a time once was the largest Protestant church in the United States. It has a very storied history. I want to first ask you about some of the history. For example, how at one time blacks were not able or legally able to preach. So they had to have a white person, white man, to be over the church. And in the preaching, they were upholding the myth that black people were to be obedient to the master.
Yes. If you go back and look at the history, the first pastor of First African Baptist Church, according to history, was Dr. Rylander, who was the president of the University of Richmond. When First Baptist Death Home Monument decided to leave and separate themselves from what they called back then the Negro, they went to the governor and got permission to leave that location and allow us to start our own congregation. It was during the time of the revolt of Nat Turner. And so the church would be full. The balcony would be full of black folk, because that time, that's where the Negro sat, in the balcony. They was becoming fearful because they was feeling outnumbered. And now you got this black man, this Negro down in Poyer area, down in that part of Virginia, is leading a revolt. So they said, we got to get away from these people. They get permission from the governor to leave and start our own church, or to become our own church. That's how it started. But yet we had to have a white pastor, and that was Dr. Rylander, who was the president of the University of Richmond. And so later on, we ended up receiving Dr. James Holmes, who became the first black pastor many years later. And if you go downtown to our old building by the VCU hospital, that red building on the corner where you get off the interstate, you will see a historical marker. That's the original building of First African Baptist Church. And if you look up on top of the building, you will see a white marker that says First Baptist Color.
Has some very prominent people that attended that church. For example, Henry Box Brown.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about Mr. Brown.
Yes, Henry Box Brown, Maggie Walker, former governor, L. Douglas Wilder. Yes, all of those persons share the history of First African Baptist Church.
But tell me about Henry Box Brown.
He decided to leave, and he put himself in a box and shipped himself north to escape slavery.
Also, I want to say Dr. Lot Carey, or was it Mr. Lot Carey?
Reverend Lot Carey.
Tell me a little bit about Reverend Lot Carey.
Reverend Lot Carey from Charles City, Virginia, was also affiliated with First African Baptist Church, had a desire to lead a mission, a campaign. He wanted to go to Liberia. So he went to Liberia. While there, he was the founder of Providence Baptist Church over there in Liberia, led a great campaign to help the people in Africa. And so the Lot Carey Convention is named after Lot Carey.
Gilbert Hunt.
I'm not so familiar with Mr. Hunt, other than actually when I just co-authored a book of the history of First African Baptist Church, where we talk about a lot of those persons who was a part of the congregation in that book. Several of those persons I am not as familiar with as others.
Well, since I asked the question, I will just say that Mr. Hunt was responsible for saving many people during a great fire in Richmond. It started at a theater, and the people were jumping out of the windows, and he stood underneath the windows and was catching, I think they say literally, like 100 people. They would just jump,
yeah.
And he caught them. And I believe that there's a play that reenacting that event. It was a huge, huge Richmond fire. I think he was a blacksmith. You are an author of at least 3 books?
Now I am the author of 4 books. My last book I co-authored with two historians, from one from BCU and the other from Virginia Union University. We just published the history of First African Baptist Church. But I am the author of Leadership Empowerment. And then I came back with the second edition of Leadership Empowerment. And then I had an experience in 2000 and I guess it was 2010 or 11, 10 or 11, where I collapsed in the pulpit. They had to call the rescue squad to come get me. And for 4 days, I literally could not walk, had no feeling in my leg. It was as though somebody stabbed me in my back. I'm finding out it was from stress and burnout. That year, I had preached 7 weeks straight every day, for 7 weeks straight, nonstop, from Sunday, preaching 3 times, twice in the morning, then on the road during a homecoming, and then preach revival. At that time, people were doing 6 days revival, 5 days, Monday through Friday. And then on Saturday, I would preach a funeral back again, Sunday 3 times. And so I collapsed and passed out. I was burdened to write a book about burning bright without burning out. And in that book, I dealt with burnout. And I talked about the necessity of rest, You got to rest. You got to take a break for your own good. You got to be willing to back away and just relax. That's why, after tomorrow, I'm going to take a few days and take a break, because you got to force yourself to back away, because you'll burn yourself out. And then the last piece, as I stated, it is the history of First Africa.
You studied at Oxford University. Tell me something about your experience.
I had an opportunity through an invitation to come to this place called Proclaimer's Place, which hosted by Dr. Joel Gregory out of Texas. And Dr. Joel Gregory is a phenomenal preacher. I had reached out to him about becoming my preacher's coach, to help coach me in preaching, to help me to become a better preacher. And through that relationship, and him being the host of Claimant's Place, which he hosts in different cities, extending an invitation for me to come to Oxford to do a week intensive on preaching. And I was fortunate to go and to take that class and to visit the different places of Oxford University. And actually in Oxford, had the privilege to see the original King James Bible, which was mind-boggling. It blew me out the water to see the size of it and have an opportunity to read from the pages and read some of the history on the King James Bible. It was just an amazing moment. So he's extending an invitation I received in the mail just this week to come back, to go to Oxford or to go to Rome and see the places where Paul actually journeyed. And so I think I'm going to be taking that trip to Rome.
Paul is one of my favorite prophets. That's talking about a turnaround attitude. Homeboy.
Yeah,
he was zealous. He was brought down to his knees. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I want to know about your handbell choir.
Yes. They were here when I came. Once a month, they, pre-pandemic, they would be a part of the morning service, especially at Communion Sunday. It is a tradition of this church. Very few people does that now, and we did not get rid of it. We kept it as a part of our worship service. They have not played, per se, since the pandemic, because we altered the service in so many ways that they have not had the privilege of playing like they would have pre-pandemic.
What's the name of the handbell? Is that Margaret R. Johnson?
Margaret R. Johnson handbell, yes.
Within your church, you provide job training opportunities, specifically in media technology and in business, and also have provided internships for college students, and I'm assuming college students within your congregation, correct?
No, because I have a relationship at Virginia Union. There are students who come to Richmond to go to school, whether undergrad or whether they are in the seminary. And many students have to do intern work. Many of them are looking for a job while they're here for seminary. And so there are many students that I have provided an opportunity to come and work here while they're here in school.
That's the internship for the college students. What are the job training opportunities that you are providing, particularly in the media technology and business sector?
Well, many run the camera. Give an example. I have three high school students now who tried to retrain them how to run the cameras during the service or any service we have, and give them the opportunity to be engaged in the worship, but also learn how to do what we do. And so while they're in school, they come in and we train them to work, and we train them to run the cameras or the sound system. Right now, I have one guy who's a student that I just brought in to play the organ, and he's from out of town. He was looking for a job, for a place, and we brought him here.
When you were talking about the old church, there was several relocation, some due to destruction by fire or such. But one of the things, when you relocated, y'all had this organ, pipe organ, that someone stole the pipes from the organ?
Yes, yes, yes. We've had several things that happen. We've had that happen, and we've also had, when we moved from the other building, the chandeliers that was in the ceiling, we were told that they had been sold. And a couple of years ago, I went back to the building and went upstairs, and the chandeliers were still hanging in the building.
So it ceased to belong to your church. It belonged to the person or the corporation that bought the building.
VCU purchased the building.
So essentially they lied, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, they lied. Yeah, let's call it what it is. Oh, well, what do you miss the most about not living on the Northern Neck besides your family?
Honestly, I don't think I miss a whole lot. You know, when you have a lot of my story have not been told, and it has not been told accurately or correct. And one of the things that hurts is when I engage people now, and they always talk about what you were. And I always hear people say, you were terrible. You was a bad child. My question is, what did I do? What did I do that the average young child didn't do, or the little kid didn't do? Because I think when you're growing up and you're a kid, everybody's mischievous in some way or another. And so when I look back and I listen to those stories, it makes you not miss anything, because I don't know what they're talking about. I know the things that I did. I know the mischievousness that I had, but But nobody knew the burden that I had in my heart. Now, maybe it was just seeking attention. But as I stated earlier, my dad literally died in my lap. I had to grow up without a father, all because two white guys was racing, and they hit us, and they killed my dad. And then on top of that, they don't get any time in jail. What does that do to anybody psychologically? Do we even think about it? And so every time I engage people, they say, oh, you, I was mischievous. I was a typical young boy trying to find my way in a community that had nothing to offer to help me to deal with the pain that I was experiencing. And so I sought attention through expressing myself in such a way that people may have called bad. But I don't know of anything that was done that's not normal for any young child growing up. I hope that makes sense.
It does. Because that leads me to this. What will you tell a young person who's still trying to figure it out, what they're going to do with their life? What will you tell them? What advice?
I would tell them to dream. I would tell them to set goals. I would tell them to never allow anybody to write the narrative for their lives other than themselves. Because you can become whatever you can want to become. And don't be afraid to lead. And don't be afraid to accept the fact that you make mistakes or you have made mistakes. But understand the mistake can help make you to become what God wants you to become. But I would tell them, don't become imprisoned by the culture. Don't become imprisoned by the fact that you feel as though you got to stay there. Matter of fact, I remember when I was getting ready to go to school, somebody asked me, what you going to school for? When I graduated with my master's and was going back to get my doctorate, somebody asked me, what you going to get that for? You don't need that. And I refused to become intoxicated by somebody else's negativity because I knew that I had to do it for me. It wasn't about them. It was for me. So I made a promise that I was going to do something to make my dad proud and God would be glorified. Because I saw the light. I woke up one day because I realized, and I would tell young people this picture, that every smile ain't a smile of love for you. Every hug ain't a hug because they care about you. Because some people will hug you to keep you locked into their culture and their world. And you got to see greater for yourself. It was almost like the movie. And I would tell them to watch that movie. You remember the movie, The Planet of Apes?
Yeah, the original one.
There was one episode in one of those series where this ape was supposed to be big and bad. And he was locked up. And finally, in this particular scene, they opened the door for him to go free, to come out. And he wouldn't. He wouldn't cross the barrier or the boundary. He pushed himself up in a corner because he had become comfortable and complacent with being locked up. And I would tell the young people, don't become comfortable and complacent with the culture locked in your mind up to make you to believe that this is all God has for you. There's more. God has a big world. This is a large world, but yet small at the same time. There's opportunities out there. You got to go out there and seek it and chase it. You got to dream. You got to become a dream chaser. You got to want more for yourself. And not bragging, God has allowed me to see greater. I've been to Africa, been to London. I've been all over this country. And who would have ever thought that young boy from Lancaster County would be going to the places that he's gone, doing what I've done? Is because I always see greater. And that's what I would tell the young people. You can become whatever you want to become if you try. And don't limit God working in your life because God is limitless. There's no boundaries. Opportunities is available if you trust him. I also want to mention to you about, you know, over the last 3 years, we've gone through a pandemic and how we were very instrumental with providing opportunities for people to come here to get the booster. We've had hundreds and thousands of persons to come to the church to get boosters from the beginning. We played a major role in being a resource center for the persons during the pandemic. And it's interesting because when I look back to 1918, when we had the influenza pandemic, First African played a major part in that. There was a lady by the name of Dr. Bessie Thorpe, who served as an assistant to Dr. William Henry Hughes, who was the physician of Miss Maggie Walker. And she was very instrumental with helping people during that time in 1918 during the influenza pandemic. And so the correlation is we've always done things to become connected to the community to make sure we're not just in church, but we are being the church. And so I wanted to throw that out because I really very appreciative how we stepped up during the pandemic.
I just saw Dr. James E.C. Norris, the son of Dr. Morgan E. Norris.
Yes.
And we were talking about you. He's very much a fan of yours.
Yeah. There's a connection with my family. Actually, Dr. Norris mentions my grandfather in his book, how my grandfather was very instrumental in the success of Dr. Norris' business.
It's always a pleasure when you can connect the dots.
Yeah.
Those generational families that make up the Northern Neck, so instrumental in the foundation of achievements, of accomplishments, particularly when it comes to the churches, how they were
the bedrock of the community.
Exactly. You sound like a wonderful, wonderful minister, Reverend Waller.
Well, I try to be the best that I can be. I'm just grateful for the journey and the fact that God would allow me to become a proclamator of his word. I am just so, so grateful, and I care about people.
I want to thank you for taking this time to talk to me. I wish you well on your journey. I know that you will do great things in that journey. You will be touching so many people, helping to strengthen our community, not only here in Richmond, but also the world at large is our community.
Yes.
I'm going to be a big part of healing what needs to be healed. So
yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I hope it was helpful.
It was wonderful.
I hope I wasn't too hard on home.
No, because the truth is the truth. Some of these questions that I ask is because it needs to be revealed. There are things that are still going on and attitude where there are people who think that, you know, who do you think you are? You used to do this or your family was this and that. You cannot be defined. You should not be defined.
Nope.
You should learn from and then go forward with that knowledge.
Yes.
I
agree.
Two negatives make a positive.
That's right. And I just have never understood why people have. Yeah, I just don't understand. And it's crazy because nobody's heard my entire story.
I'm glad that you shared it with me. Thank you.
Yeah.
Go forth and conquer, young man.
I will, ma'am. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Reverend Waller.
All right. All right.
Bye-bye. Never let it be said what you can't do. What you believe you can do, it can be done. For a belief that is as small as a mustard seed can grow into a mighty tree. The music by Robert A. Hall. I dedicate this interview to the churches of the counties of the Northern Neck of Virginia and beyond. They were and remain a foundation. Thank you for listening.